We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the annual mid-year conference of UNSW, a one-week residential conference of several hundred students. These talks and question times formed the evening program after the students had undertaken a solid day of Bible study.
Well, now in this evening's talk, there's going to be bits and pieces that some of you have heard before. Some of the cards that are to be played are the same as I've played before, but the particular shuffle that we're using is a new shuffle, so that they actually come out in a new perspective. And we're speaking on the on a real backdrop to the whole week in this address on the character of God. But I'll actually be homing in on a particular aspect of the character of God, and it's a very sad and unhappy address, and I'm sorry about that. So it is not one that can really be full of jokes and happiness and bright breezy start to make everybody feel better. I hope you've had it, because you won't get it for the next little while, I'm sorry to say. But let's think about the great fire in the cathedral at York Minster. Was it the judgment of God? Did you hear about it? Sure, you all heard about it. Last weekend, the Archbishop of York consecrated a bishop, a man who actually didn't believe in the Apostles' Creed, as ordained as a bishop in that part of the world. Didn't believe Jesus was born of a virgin. It's fairly questionable about his attitudes towards Jesus' resurrection. Very questionable his attitude towards the truth and authority of the Bible. He is now a consecrated bishop in England. The next day, was it, or within a very short period of time, still the same weekend, without any known reason, they think it was lightning, a large section of the cathedral was burnt to the ground. It only stood there for about 1,100 years, and the roof caved in, the whole deal, and the stained glass is cracked, and it's one of the greatest cathedrals in Europe, and massive destruction. Now, was that the judgment of God? Some people have clearly said yes. Other people said that's ridiculous. Other people say, oh, well, What do you say? About 4 years ago, in our church, great joy was had when one of the congregation members had a child born to them, a little boy that we're all very happy to have born, and third in the family. The other two were girls, so everyone was kind of semi-hoping for the boy this time. Just as about to leave hospital, they found that he'd been born with cancer. Is that the judgment of God? Or was that God losing control of the world? Where do you see God in that? How does that fit in? Or, about a year or so ago now, a bit more, in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, isn't it? The main city there. The government soldiers, Marxist government there, came to one of the local churches, Baptist Church, took all the people who were there, gathered for Sunday morning gathering, took them out. They've never been seen or heard since. The week after, they went to the Presbyterian Church and did the same thing. The week after, they went to a third church, did the same thing. Those churches, whole congregations, completely gone. Now, is that the judgment of God? Is that God losing control? Is that God falling asleep? Why don't you talk to the person next to you for a little while about it? There's three events. How do you put those together in terms of what God is doing in the world today? Are any of them the judgment of God? Some of them, none of them, all of them. How do you cope with that? Give you a couple of minutes. Good, well, there's lots to talk of, I'm sure, but how about we pull it back together again now for a little while? Nice to hear all the arts people here. Yes. Inside your book, your Take It Everywhere, mid-year conference book, inside, inside that you'll find some sheets of different colours, don't you? And I'm now dealing on the sheet that is... entitled Studies... Character of God. All got it there? All in business? Often when you're talking with people, and especially when you're in disagreement with people about the things of God, you'll hear them using the phrase, well, I like to think of God like. That is a very, very common phrase. You've never heard it. In actual fact, you have. You've never actually taken it in that they're saying it, because people are often using it. I like to imagine that God's, well, the way I think about God, it's, I like to think of God as, there's a whole string of ways of saying it, but it's the same thing. Sometimes it's just of, I think of God as. And when people like to think of God, what do they like to think of? Love is one of the great things, yes. In our love-ridden and love-sick society, that's one of the big things we come on. But there are others too, like Father or Spirit or gentle or kind or forgiving or open or accepting or the whole variety of things that people like to think of God as. Sometimes when they talk about what I do think of God as opposed to what I like to think of God as, they will say he's mean and just, unjust and harsh and a wowser and a killjoy and a policeman and all kinds of other nasty things, which is a bit rough on policemen, isn't it? All kinds of nasty things that they might want to think about as far as God is like. When people say that, it tells you a lot about what they're thinking and nothing about God. Tells you what they're thinking, but doesn't tell you about what God is like. Let me give you an example. You see? I like to think of the Antarctica as a place resplendent with magnificent vegetables and wild animals, right? See, I'm telling you nothing about Antarctica, am I? I'm just telling you about what I like thinking. Which is nuts. Yeah, I'd like them in Antarctica too. And right? So when I say, I like to think of God as, that tells you nothing about God. Absolutely nothing. It may tell you a lot about the person. Well then, what we've got to deal with is not the God that I like to think of is there, but the God who is there. That's the God with whom we have to deal. And it's an abiding problem of our generation, of us, that we constantly want to put God under scrutiny. We want to put God in the dock and judge him and evaluate him. We want to put God through the examination process. And we keep forgetting that far more important than what I think of God is what God thinks of me. Which is more significant in the long run? What you think of your examiner or what your examiner thinks of you? You may say, well, my opinion's very important. Well, it may be. And they don't give you degrees on the basis of your opinion. They give you degrees on the basis of your ability to reduplicate his opinion. Or something like that. And his opinion of you is what gives you the degree, not your opinion of him. You can put out your counter handbook and say all the nasty things you like, but in the end, it changes little. The God who is there is the God we have to deal with. We have to learn to accept. Not put through the examination process, nor modify to fit in with our mindset as to what we think would be an acceptable God. Now, how can we know the God who is there? There are different ways to knowledge. many different ways to knowledge, and different forms of knowledge, different areas of knowledge require different methodology. In this last week or two, and I've been at Sydney University to mission, I've had several people come to me and attack me with considerable intellectual vigour, none physically, I'm relieved to say, but considerable intellectual vigour, and very frequently it's been in this kind of area. I had a man who was in fourth year chemistry saying to me a whole range of very strange and peculiar things about only believing scientific fact. The fact that he got through to fourth year science in Sydney University says something about the kind of people they let into fourth year at science at Sydney University, something about Sydney University. What is scientific fact? It has a very, very poor understanding of the scientific method. Very little scientific fact. Science doesn't deal with that. It deals with observations. Right? Observations which confirm, deny theories, if you like. It doesn't deal with facts like that. That's popular science. That's Reader's Digest science. Well, if that's good enough to get you through fourth year at Sydney University, you can see why you've chosen to go where you have, can't you? I knew that attitude would win here. It's different to what I've been saying in the last week, can't I say? However, that's another story. What he wanted about God was that he wanted God to actually fit into the concept of scientific methodology. And if we could fit God into the concept of context of scientific methodology, then we'd believe in God. So I raised with him that famous line that comes from Monty Python, which I've not seen, that sex is better than logic, but I can't prove it. It's a good line, isn't it? Because it raises the whole question of the nature of knowledge. No one's going to deny it, especially in our sex-ridden society. They're not going to say, oh no, sex isn't nearly as good as logic. I love logic. I mean, if you say that in our society, you really... Everyone takes a good step back from you and kind of wonders, don't they? No, everyone's going to say, yeah, of course sex is better than logic, but how do you set about proving something like that? How are you going to fit that into a test tube somewhere? You know, what kind of hypothesis? The logic I was thinking of. What kind of hypothesis are you going to actually solve? I mean, you've actually, what Python is saying is that the whole thing is actually, there are different methods of knowledge. There is not one model. So I asked this man to scientifically prove to me the fact of Captain Cook's visit to Australia. And he says, well, you just need to run experiments. I said, you must run experiments, of course, which are, you can reduplicate, you can do again. I mean, that's part of the characteristic of scientific evidence, isn't it? You've got to be able to do the, you know. So we've got to get Captain Cook visiting regularly so that we can check him up to see whether he's... You see, you move out of chemistry into history, you've got to use different analysis, different methods of analysis, different modes of thinking are required as you move from one area to another. The mode in mathematics is different to the mode of thinking in law and in the courtroom scene. That's a very different mode of thinking. Now, what are the kinds of normal modes of thinking that you have available to you? Briefly, the normal ones you've got are things like empiricism, or rationalism, or intuitionism. We operate a lot on intuition. I just have this knowledge of this person, this sense of what this other person is like. I can't put in words, but, you know, by the way they act, the way they behave, I get a sense of what the world is like. Sometimes, of course, my intuitions are completely wrong, aren't they? I still intuitively believe the world is flat and the sun rises. That's my intuition. I mean, I go outside there, it looks flat. I watch the sun and it goes up and comes down. My intuition is fairly straightforward that that's the way it is. But yet, I have been shown that it's more reasonable to perceive the world is round than that the world is going around the sun. I still talk about the sunrise, but I believe in the world revolve. Just is not as kind of romantic to talk about the world revolve. It's harder to say, I saw the world revolve. Now, empiricism puts up hypotheses and looks at the evidence that contradict those hypotheses. To be able to put up more hypotheses that will better conform themselves, more models of thought that will conform itself more accurately to the way the world is. It's very good for certain kinds of pieces of knowledge. But it's very different to rationalism, which is a completely deductive system. Empiricism always has this problem that it's not foolproof. You know, we can always find more. The theories always change. There was a time when you thought Isaac Newton was perfect, absolutely right. Except for those of us who still are on Reader's Digest Physics, don't think that anymore. We've heard of a man called Albert Einstein and other people who have thought some other thoughts. Can't understand them, but we've got them in their world. So we know Newton's now not altogether right because of these other Charlies, but we're not... So empiricism keeps moving. Never comes to the final statement. Rationalism, though, it's a deductive system. Mathematics is the classic rationalist system that you know about. You get a certain proposition, certain method of operation, and everything will follow from that. And you've either got the right answer or you haven't got the right answer. It's absolute. That's the beauty of maths. That's why some people actually get turned on by it. It's so neat. It's so absolute. It's so intricate and clever and yet final. It's marvellous. It's just got nothing to do with life. It's just a mental construct. But if I play the rules, this is how it'll turn out. It's like chess. Chess is a classic form of maths. That's all it is. It's got nothing to do with life as such, but it's got its own internal organisation which makes it right or wrong. You can do that, you can't do that. Now, it's very useful, but it's different. All of those are different, right? How do you know God? Empiricism? Rationalism? Intuitive thought? Well, you can use to some element all those processes of thought, but the way in which the Bible speaks of knowing God is quite different. It's revelational. It's revelational. It's a different method of knowledge again. Reveals himself. He reveals himself. And it's an interesting thing. It's a form of knowledge that we commonly practice. We all know about it, actually. You possibly never sat back and thought about it, but we all know about it. Revelation is the way of knowing people. Revelation is the way of knowing people. It is as people express themselves that you come to know them. See, people are unlike other things. When I'm analysing this board, the board doesn't analyse me. When I look at a book, the book doesn't look at me. My trouble with people is when I look at them, they look at me. I wish you wouldn't at the moment, you know. They look back at me. But it's the one object which is really also a subject. It makes all comparisons difficult. Great problem with the psychologist and the rat, isn't it? As to how much you can actually then apply it to the human. Because the human is actually different. And especially at this point that he actually can analyse the test that you're running on him at the time you're running it. He may have even invented the test. It's a great problem, you see. The only way you get to know people is by people revealing themselves to you. Now, I sat down next to someone tonight that I had never met before. And they knew me, I didn't know them. To be honest, I didn't know whether I knew them or not. It's even more embarrassing, I didn't know whether I was supposed to know them or not. But they knew that who I was, because I had revealed myself to them. Because they had been along to things like Katoomba Youth Convention, where they had heard me speak and where they knew my name. They had the name and the person attached together, so they got the right label. And as I speak, I say all kinds of things about myself that I don't even necessarily mean to say, but which give away things, don't they? Right? I've been to Sydney University in the last couple of weeks. Some of you didn't know that. Now you all know it, though. I didn't mean to actually tell you. I'm not going around saying, I have been to Sydney University. But in the process of just making an illustration, I give it away. I'm a person who obviously needs his hands to talk. See? That kind of person. I reveal myself even in the body language, in the clothes I choose to wear. There's a whole range of ways in which we are revealing ourselves. But there are statements I'm making that tell you more and more about me. And as you hear more and more about me, you say, I know him. Of course, the funny part is, in a sense, you don't, because I didn't even know who this person was. So I sat down next to the person, and this person started telling me things about themselves. Like their name, well, that was fairly easy. It was written on the lovely big name tag, so I could guess that. Right, I was able to read it. And so that was the first step, and then I said, which church do you go to? And they told me, and what course are you doing? And they told me, and as they started telling me these things, I started to get to feel like I knew that person. If they had said nothing, I'd be very mystified about who they were and what they were and what's wrong with them. But I would also have no personal knowledge of them, would I? At the end of the mealtime, I'd go away saying, well, there's a very quiet person here. So quiet, I'm not even sure that it's a person. I know what's going on inside there, if there is anything inside there. I don't know that person, do I? They have told me nothing about themselves, nothing that can give me that sense that I know them. That is, the way in which people knowledge comes about is by revelation. The key understanding is that, because if, as the Bible says is true, if God is personal, then the way in which we will know God is by his revelation of himself to us. It is as God speaks and tells us about himself that we can know about him. We don't know it by empiricism, we don't know it by rationalism, even by intuition, but by revelation. Let me put it the other way, just so as to make sure you get the point. If I got you all to sit in a quiet corner somewhere and think up God, rationalistic process, just by thought, by visions and coming to you, that you wouldn't come up to any conclusion about who God is. You can't. I know people have tried, and that's where you get those famous things like the traditional proofs for the existence of God. They're all rationalistic processes, especially the famous ontological one. But they actually tell you nothing about God. You get them from you get the ideas from elsewhere. You just don't come to that kind of conclusion about God. So, the only way you know God is by God speaking. But once God expresses, then you've got to deal with a God who is there and who has revealed himself to be like this and like that. Now, you don't have to do that with me. I'm a liar. You know I'm a liar, don't you? The Bible tells you I'm a liar. All men are liars. That's what the Bible says, and I'm a man, so therefore I qualify. I can give you personal testimony on the matter too, but I'm not going, don't, you see. But God is not a liar. That is one of the characteristics of God that's different. So that what I say about myself is not always true, is it? Sometimes I'm saying things about myself so as to impress you, so as to make you think better of me than I am, or possibly so as to make you think worse of me, so that you'll give me some sympathy and kindness, and I've got a terrible sort of back, you know. And really feel aged, and you can run around and get me a cup of coffee and tea, and I go, oh, yeah. So sometimes I'm lying for a variety of reasons, but God never lies. And so what he says about himself is the truth. Therefore, I mustn't deal with God how I like, but God who is there. And God who is there reveals himself to be this kind of person, this kind of character, with this kinds of plans, purposes, attitudes, values, and all the rest of it. And they're the ones I've got to deal with. Now, what does it say? Well, I've got a whole book full of it here. Let's just think of a couple of sentences. Who can think of any sentence where the Bible says, God is, and then says something else? What does it say God is? God is spirit, John chapter 4, yes? God is love, which 1 John 4:16, God is. Alright, what am I doing? You're just wandering around or wobbling or something, am I? Or have I monkeyed it up? Consuming fire, where do you get that, Narada? You can't remember. In the Bible. Hebrews somewhere, isn't it? 13? Good. Hebrews 13. Yes, what else? Yes, you're a jealous God. Visit the sins of the fathers upon the children of the third, fourth generation. Where do you get that one from? Old Testament. Peter? God is not mocked. Yes, that's a clever one I hadn't thought of, yes. God is not mocked. I've got a friend called Joe Mock. God is not mocked. No, that's not it, is it? Sorry? God is light. Me and him is no darkness at all. Where is that? 1 John, yes? 1 John 1?
Sorry? God is consistent.
I know where that is. That is in a modern translation.
Whereabouts? Genesis where?
It's just revealed throughout, isn't it? His character comes across, yeah? Kind of Tracy night tonight. God is in heaven above. That's an interesting one, yes? Yeah, Ecclesiastes. Yes, yeah, in Isaiah 45, isn't it? God is not a chaos but an order. Yes, slow to mercy and abounding in, yeah, that's, you get that in all kinds of places. Where won't you? Where will you get the easiest? Exodus, Psalm 103. Yes. Yeah, Psalm 103, as far as the east is from the west, so will I separate the sins from you. That's right, isn't it? We know, don't we? Kerry and I got it. You also get it in Exodus 34. Hmm? Yeah, whatever, where else? All kinds of things said about God, isn't there? That's just taking the God is kind of phrase. One of the ones you've missed, though, it's fairly obvious, I would have thought. Yes, he is that. I'm not sure where I'll find that, you know? The old Psalm 90 does do that, isn't it? Yes, because it's verse 2, thank you. Yes, that's the one that you get that great hymn, God our help in ages past, you know, from time like an ever-rolling thing. It's about time and eternity. Yeah, I am the Alpha and the Omega. Because the word am is, of course, the word is in the first person singular as opposed to the third. I am, you are, he is. It's the same verb, am and is. Now, once I've done that to you, what else have you got there?
I am.
All the I am sayings, and the ultimate I am saying, I am. I am who I am. That's who I am, I am. It reminds me of that marvellous book about green eggs and ham. I'm Sam, I am. Okay, well, but all the I am the door, I am the good shepherd, I am the truth, the way and the life. Yes, so you've got a whole range of I am's once you start bringing in the verb am as opposed to is. Yeah? Now, all kinds of things are said about God, aren't they? And his character, a variety of things, some of which are a little bit on the heart to hold together. Especially the ones about being gracious and kind and merciful and being vengeful. Being a consuming fire and so on. It's hard to put those together a bit, isn't it? One that you've left out, or have I forgotten? You might have said it and I've forgotten. Well, love we had. Faithfulness. We haven't said faithfulness, which I always thought was a pretty important one. Jealousy. Is he a jealous God? Just? Yes, he is the word. Righteous God? Holy God. Yes, I would have thought holiness was one of the chief ones. That's the one I was thinking. The others are great. Maybe if I hang around long enough, we'll get some more good ones out. Yes. But holiness is one of the chief characteristics of God, which in another way of saying it too is he is perfect. Be perfect as I am perfect. Be holy as I am holy. The word holy is a funny word. It means different. Well, in one sense, we're all holy, aren't we? Some are more holy than others. Now, that's what the word means. And because God is fundamentally different. Now, what aspects and character is different? Well, in his power and his might, but in his purity and his perfection, he is different. And so the word then starts to mean pure, right, as opposed to righteous. Well, God is all those things. Now, you'll see on the third heading there, I've got the opposite of love is, dot, 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 question mark. And I must confess, it was only about a few minutes ago, just before I left my room and walked down here, that I remembered that there was a word called hate, which I presume is the opposite of love. That wrecks up my whole point. So if you wouldn't just mind leaving hate out for a few minutes, what is the opposite of love? See, love's a favourite word, and it's a very overworked word at the moment, even when you get a careful definition of it or write a book on it, like C.S. Lewis did on the four loves. You've got a problem with the word love. What do you think is at the essence of the word love? I think it's got to do with giving. It's got to do with giving. different characteristics of the giving, but it's got to do with giving, is what the Bible is meaning by the word love. And the opposite of love then is very much taking. That is, love is all about the other. The opposite of love is all about myself. Now, I can fit hate into that, you see, because hate is always actually myself. It's got to do with me. But there is another opposite to love, another opposite dimension to love. It's a dreadful, dreadful one that you and I don't think about very often. Our world doesn't grasp hold of. And it's not the way the world thinks at all. The opposite of love is also indifference. Indifference is an opposite to love. Not caring about the other person at all. You know, I don't give a fig about you. It's a magnificent statement of lack of love. Now, you get it, for example, in 1 John 3:17. There's a verse there, it's all about love, that section. It's a hard one to find and it's a short one to read, so just let me read it for you. 1 John 3:17, if anyone has material possessions, sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? You know, if you're just indifferent to people in their needs, how can you say that you love them? That's ridiculous, you see. If you can just allow people around about you to be in pain and turmoil, indifference is a terrible opposite of love. When you see that, then you'll see that one of the things that is not the opposite of love is anger. Because anger is never a matter of indifference. Now, there's a trouble with the word anger. That is, anger can get both right and wrong about it. We're taught in James chapter 1 that the anger of man doesn't work the righteousness of God. It's James 1, 19, 20. And the anger of man doesn't, because so much our anger is self-centered anger, isn't it? So much of our anger is loss of control. In fact, we even talk about losing my temper as being the same as anger. But there is an anger that is right. There is an anger which is, again, the opposite of indifference. Let me tell you a very quick story in the hope as to make you angry. I want you to be angry now. In fact, the Bible tells you to be angry now in Ephesians 4. Be angry, but do not sin. Now I'll give you a little story that I hope will make you angry. You ready? Outside St. Vincent's Hospital is a little bus shelter. And about 3-4 years ago, there was a poor old man there, an old alcoholic, who'd bedded down for the night in the bus shelter. And a group of youths came down and got his metho bottle and poured it all over him and set him alight. How are your emotions at the moment, friends? If your emotions are completely placid on that story, if you can say, oh, well, you know, boys will be boys. There's no love of God in you, is there? The person who can treat that with moral indifference is almost as sick as the kids who did it. Is that right? That feeling of, oh, that's revolting, that's shocking, you know. That feeling is a perfectly right, appropriate form of love, isn't it? You should feel it. I hope you do feel it. Now, I won't do it to you again, but I can rattle out 100 other horrible stories in life, and they should all have the same effect on you. You should not be able to read about what happened in the Second World War in Belsen, etc. You shouldn't be able to read about what Pol Pot has done to the Kampucheans. You shouldn't be able to read what Idi Amin did to so many of the tribesmen in Uganda. You shouldn't be able to hear about that things without some emotions coming into you. Some emotions of hostility and anger at the situation. You must feel that way if you've got any concern for the world or any concern for people. So anger is not the opposite of love. It can be if it's just that self-centered losing your temper, but it may not be. On another occasion, it actually can be the very expression of love. And I say that because, you see, one of the characteristics, or two of the characteristics of God, is his great compassion and love, and his wrath and vengeful anger. And lots of people try and cope with those two things by saying only one of them is true. And the one they usually go for is love. Although if they don't want to be a Christian, they usually go for the wrath. And the Christian has got to take God as he reveals himself to be, not as the Christian wants to think him up. And as he reveals himself to be is both love and anger. Both things. And he is both and expresses himself in both. He is a jealous God. He is a vengeful God. He is a consuming fire. And he is a merciful God. A generous God, a gracious God, a loving God. He is both those things at the same time. Now, if you make those mutually contradictory, he can't be both those things at the same time. But if you ponder about it for a while, you'll see that actually his very wrath and vengeance, his very jealousy, can be an expression of his love. Now, if it can be an expression of his love, then those things are not mutually contradictory, are they? So what we need to fix in our minds, having heard the revelation that God is all those things, we now have to fix our mind up to be able to cope with those things. If I like to think of God this way and I find out he's not this way but that way, well, the thing that needs to be changed, my mind. I can't drop out pieces of the data that I don't like. God is a God of wrath and anger, of vengeance, of jealousy. Now, jealousy, again, you see, we normally take as a negative thing, don't we? Very hard to see jealousy as a positive thing. Oh, yes, it is. It's a perfectly positive, good, it's a right thing. It's a right thing. You should be jealous. You should be perfectly right to be jealous. I mean, a man's wife is seduced by another man. What is he supposed to say? Oh, that's all right. We're friends, share all things in common. He will say that if he doesn't care for his wife. But if he loves his wife, it is right for him to be jealous over that, isn't it? It's a perfectly right thing. Which of the women here doesn't want a jealous husband in those circumstances? Of course you want your husband to be jealous then, don't you? It's a very expression of love. It's a right thing. Trouble with your jealousy and my jealousy is it's so often wrong, isn't it? We get jealous over things that we've got no rights to. And we get jealous over, and our jealousy gets control of us and we lose control, like our temper, and we go off the fire and all kinds of stupid things and accuse them of things they've never done and all kinds of stupidities. But there is a jealousy that's right. And that is the jealousy of God. He is jealous for his name. He gives the people of Israel his name. And they go and flaunt it. He marries the people of Israel and they go off and become a prostitute. That is the jealousy of God then that is aroused. Now, when you look at the world we're in at the moment, it really is a terrible mess. But it's nothing to what it's going to be like. Before we get on to this fourth and last, for the second last title and big section here for a moment, how are the chairs? Pretty hard? Want to sing a chorus standing up, or do you want to just stand up? Sing a chorus. It'd be a nice thing to do when we still. Who has got a nice favourite chorus in these two chorus? Ventilation in, are we? What happens if you open those doors there, or does that get noisy? Okay. No? Cold. Sorry, I haven't been to bed yet. Wait till you find out how cold that all is. Well, what a mess. The word hell is not used very much in the Bible. In fact, it's only, I think, used 12 times, 11 of which are on the mouth of Jesus. It's the word Gehenna, which is the municipal garbage dump just outside of Jerusalem. People were thrown there, convicts, unwanted people, beggars and the rest. I mean, if you were a person of any dignity and significance, you were buried in a grave, proper ceremony. But if you're just a pauper, just a nothing, just a nobody, or someone who died in disgrace, then you were just heaved onto the rubbish dump and were eaten by the rats. Now, there's something kind of ignominious about having your body treated like that, isn't there? I mean, in a sense, it doesn't matter. Your body's dead anyway. But in a sense, it reduces you to being less than human for you to be on public display as fodder for the rats, for the worms, for the fire and the stench. It just shows that your whole life ended in ruin and destruction. It's a dreadful way to finish. And Jesus takes this very graphic picture of something that was happening just down the road. He takes this graphic picture to talk about eternity for some people. Very sad scene, but unfortunately all true too of humanity. What is this hell business about, and what is the wrath of God, and how does it work in this world? The wrath of God is a result of God's character, is part of God's character. Punishment that is inflicted on the world, the way the world is, it's the result of God's character. It comes from him. Habakkuk 1:13 says that God is too pure to look upon sin. Can have nothing to do with it. It's his holiness which makes it impossible for him to have anything to do with sinfulness. Or take Nahum. You don't often take Nahum, so why don't we head and try and find Nahum? First place you go to is the table of contents. I'm going to read a few verses, so look them up this time. Nahum. For those of you who don't know, that is N-A-H-U-M. Nahum. It's kind of like a horse chant. Nahum. Just need a table of contents. I don't think you need much consultation, do you? Oh, just go ahead. I don't care. You ready? Chapter 1. Only had three to choose from. Verse 2. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and maintains his wrath against his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. He will not leave the guilty unpunished. His way is in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and dries it up. He makes all the rivers run dry. Bashan and Carmel wither, and the blossoms of Lebanon fade. The mountains quake before him, and the hills melt away. The earth trembles at his presence, and the world and all who live in it. Who can withstand his indignation? Who can endure his fierce anger? His wrath is poured out like fire. The rocks are shattered before him. It's out of his very character, you see, of being a jealous, avenging God, that he takes action in punishment against sinful people. He cannot be the God he is, loving the world that he does, loving humanity as he does, and be indifferent to what is happening here. That's not an option that's available. Because of his own holy righteousness, he is a jealous and avenging God who takes vengeance. But notice also that part and parcel of that is the treating of humans as responsible. The treating as humans as responsible. Now you see it throughout the Old Testament. Genesis chapter 3 is God taking vengeance upon the people, Adam and Eve, who rebel against him. The earth becomes hard and difficult for man. The marriage bond becomes difficult for the woman. They're driven away from the tree of life. See, God takes punishment on people who rebel and muck up his garden and his world. See it in Genesis chapter 6. God is horrified by the sinfulness of people, and so he sends the great flood to destroy the whole of mankind, Genesis 6. You see it in Genesis chapter 18. God sees the outcry against him in Sodom and Gomorrah, and he shows it to Abraham before he destroys those wicked cities. Genesis 18 and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Over and again, you see, in God, in his concern for mankind and his concern for righteousness and his own very character of being holy and righteous and jealous and loving, strikes forth in vengeance. Slowly, slow to anger. Notice, slow to anger. That doesn't mean a sinister delight in punishment. Let us drag it out as long as we can. No, that's not what's meant. Slow to anger means not like you and I, temperamental. God is an angry God, but he's not a temperamental God. Now, most of our anger that is wrong is temperamental anger, isn't it? You just lose control, your flashpoint comes, and you know, you stomp on somebody. It's not like that. It's measured and weighed, it's just and right. That this is the right thing to do. And it pays people for what they have done. It's always measured with justice. and treats people as responsible beings. Now, the classic in that, of course, is in Ezekiel chapters 18 and 33, which we studied in Campus Bible Study this year, and which will be, say, summed up in Romans 2:6, a verse that you'll be looking at tomorrow sometime, I trust. Romans 2:6 says, God will give to each person according to what he has done. God will give to each person according to what he has done. Ezekiel 18, Ezekiel 33 is about God not giving the children the punishment for the fathers, but actually each soul bearing the responsibility for their own crimes. Now, responsibility, friends, is a very, very important concept. It's early in the week, so I'm going to labour all kinds of points that are slightly off the track. Here is another very important one. Came out of Sydney University Law School, actually. Met this law student, came out after the lecture there. It was a great time we had. Only about 30 or 40 were there. But two or three people were converted during that meeting. It was really a very exciting time. And after it, this student came who was certainly not converted, but wanted to... Here because we're here because we're here. That's right, he said. And so... if that's all that we're here for, where do you get the idea that there's such a thing as justice? Where's that fit in? Where's this concept fair play? What's fair play? I mean, you're an organism that's evolved, and I'm an organism that's evolved, and the timber that went into that's another organism that's evolved, and we're just here because we're here, aren't we? We're all just accidents. If everything is just purely accidental, where's the idea that there's a right and a wrong? A just and an unjust, a fair and an unfair. I said, in fact, all the decisions you and I make are just like Mr. Skinner says, it's all just a matter of operant conditioning, isn't it? You do what you're programmed to do. He likes Skinner. Yes, that's right. So it's not my fault, is it? So I said, no, nothing's your fault, because everything you do is just a matter of program. You're an evolved mechanism that has been programmed up to give this kind of atheistic response. That's all you are. Your decision's meaningless, really. One way or another, all decisions are meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And the idea that God should be fair is meaningless too. Well, we didn't see him converted. Another one of the cases where you win arguments and lose friends. But there's a great problem, you see, about removing God. People think they can remove God and still have a person left, a human left. What they don't realise is the very idea of what a person is dependent upon God. You take away God and you will actually remove what is a person. Try and grasp hold of it, friends, because so often we get browbeaten by atheists and we think that they're actually very clever, and in actual fact atheism is a terrible stupidity. It's a real nonsense in the end. Persons, the idea of persons is dependent upon the idea of a personal God. Get rid of the personal God and you'll get rid of persons as well. You see, there is no right and wrong, there's only just what is. What is what is. That's what is. And it's silly to hold somebody responsible for what they're doing, because they're only doing what they've been conditioned to do. They can't help it. Now, if you're a good Marxist, he's an atheist, of course, a good Marxist, you say, well, you are just expressing your own socio-economic class, aren't you, in the great struggle. Your values are the values of your class, and that's all it is. It's not true or false. Nothing is true or false in Marxism. That's why they're such good liars. Or you can go into Durkheim and that kind of sociological analysis. Your view of the world is determined by your social context, which has framed the world for you, and so you can't actually ever think of the world outside of that context, and so all your decisions are just an expression of the sociological forces that have made you the person you are. And so if you were born in India, you'd be Hindu. Because you're born in Australia, you're a Christian. Doesn't make Hinduism right or Christianity. Oh, they're all just an expression of your kind of sociological background, aren't they? See, it sounds so clever and sophisticated. And you can do it on the B.F. Skinner line, you see. You're being conditioned by a whole group of processes, and so you believe what you believe, but in each of these, friends, notice what's lacking. A person who makes a meaningful decision. That's what's missing. In every one of these atheistic philosophies, the same thing happens. The person gets reduced to a machine. The person gets reduced to a mechanism,
maybe a biological mechanism like Freud. It might be an economic mechanism like Marx. It may be a sociological mechanism like Durkheim. It may be a psychological one, an educational one like Skinner. But it's still the same. It's still a mechanism. No longer a person. And therefore, no personal responsibility. That's the bit they love. I can't help it. It's just the way I've been made. Blame my grandmother. If you can find her. Now, this is reflected in our society, in our society's thinking. Hands up those who are lost already. On board with it? It's a very negative way of saying it, you see. Hands up those who are lost. All right, now let me tell you how it comes out in society. You see, what do you do with criminals? Now, I'm not sure prisons are good things or bad things, and I'm not talking about prisons, but that's what our society does. I mean, in other societies, you chop thieves' hands off rather than putting them in prison, which is more barbaric, I'm never too sure. But seeing we're dealing with a society that has prisons, I want to talk about prisons, right? Without thinking of Katingal or any particular prison in mind. What do we do with criminals? We put them in prison. Why? Why do we put them in prison? Well, there are four reasons. Three are given by every atheist. One is only ever given by Christianized people. Sometimes the Christians don't give the one, they only give the three that the atheists give. The three the atheist gives all sound very, very convincing when you hear them. I hope they sound convincing. They should be, they are. But they're stupid. Now, the first one is rehabilitation. Here is a person who is doing something that is obviously unacceptable, and so what we do is we put him in prison. It was just 2 years ago here, I was standing here and I talked about incarcerating a man in prison behind bars. I thought Rex Mossop had nothing on me. Check up incarcerated later and you'll realise my problems. Anyway, you put him in prison. What are you doing in putting him in prison? See? You're rehabilitating him, or you're hoping to. Now, I know the prisons aren't very good at doing it, but that's the idea that some people have, that we actually put him through a training program, through psychological, through counselling programs, give him a trade, give him an education, and hopefully through the whole process, he will somehow come out a better person who won't go and do that kind of thing again. That's one reason. Another reason is so as to prevent him from repeating his crime. He's a bloke going around stealing, making bank robberies. We don't want a bloke going around knocking over banks. Therefore, we lock him up away from banks. Preventative, see? Rehabilitation, preventative. Third one is deterrence. You see, if we let this bloke go around knocking over banks all the time, then what's going to stop everybody else doing it as well? So what we do is we lock him up publicly, public trial, write it up in the newspapers, put him in prisons, and we say, this is what we will do to anybody else who wants to go knocking over banks. And so we deter other people by putting him in prison. Fourth argument that people have is what we do is we put him into prison because he's done the wrong thing and he deserves to be punished. Now that fourth one, you see, sounds mean. It's vengeance, isn't it? That's what we're doing. It's kind of like New Guinea payback. You stomped on my toe. Okay, put your toe out, stomp. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Sounds very rough, doesn't it? Sounds vengeful. And so we don't like that anymore. We've dropped number four out. We stick with the first three. And New South Wales did it classically about 10 years ago, I think under the Askin government, when it changed it from the Department of Prisons to the Department of Corrective Services. 1984 is a marvellous year to take careful notice of the phrase. A Department of Corrective Services comes straight out of George Orwell, as far as I can see. Who's correcting whom, on whose standard, to what end? Very sinister title, if you actually think about it. It's a dreadful title when you think about it. A prison, I know what you're doing, but a corrective service, I've got no idea what you're doing. What happens if the only way I can rehabilitate you, the only way I can correct you, is by a total lobotomy? Is that fair? I mean, I know you only stole a matchbox, but the point is, the lobotomy will stop you stealing matchboxes in the future, won't it? Stop you doing most things in the future. That's all right. You won't steal matchboxes anymore. You will be rehabilitated, won't you? So that is a successful program, isn't it? Oh, well, you've got some other ones then. You don't want the lobotomy? All right, well, I'll prevent you from ever stealing another matchbox. You're locked up forever. As long as there are matchboxes, we will keep you locked up. That way you'll never steal another matchbox, will you? Perfect preventative. No, I don't like that very much. Well, all right, let me use the third argument. We will give you a lobotomy and lock you up forever. Because by giving you a lobotomy and locking you up forever, who else will ever try and steal a matchbox? Huh? That is the perfect deterrent, isn't it? One matchbox and you too will be lobotomized in prison forever. You say to me, yeah, well, that's all stupid. That's not going to be the case. Have you ever read the Gulag Archipelago? Ever read Solzhenitsyn and what they do in Russia? Ever worked out the basis of the Russian putting people away in psychiatric hospitals, losing them there in the salt mines of Siberia? It's on the basis of people whom they want to rehabilitate. It's on the basis of preventing people who are anti the state from doing antisocial things, or anti-Soviet things, or anti-socialist things. It all gets a little confused there. It's on the basis that they want to deter other people from being anti-socialist, anti-Soviet, anti-society. It is exactly those arguments that got Adolf Hitler to put the Jews inside prison, inside gas chambers. It's the same argument that the New South Wales Department of Corrective Services used. What can ever stop it going that way? Well, it's the fourth argument, that you can never do it to anybody except the guilty. And you do it to the guilty because he deserves it. Unless you have a sense of treating people as responsible beings who are going to be given what they deserve, unless you have that, you have the most sinister, dreadful scenario for the future. Now, because the atheist has pulled the plug on God, the bathwater of human personality has run out. All you're left is with mechanisms. You and I are just mechanisms who need programming and reprogramming by social engineers. And when the program gives out unsatisfactory results, they need reprogramming in things like prisons and psychiatric care. You've got no way of arguing against that, none at all, unless you're going to reintroduce an idea like justice, fairness, responsibility, personality. But you can't reintroduce those if you haven't got a personal God, if you've only got an accidental universe. So you see, the atheist is always caught in his own dilemma, the humanist society classically. They want to have moral values in a world that is a moral vacuum. You can't have it both ways. Get rid of God by all means, but live out the terror that follows. If you've got God, though, personal God, you've got a God who treats people responsibly. And in treating people responsibly, gives them what they deserve. And if what they deserve is punishment, then that is what he will give them. Retribution is fundamental to a personal God. Comes out of his character of holiness and righteousness and a person, and comes to us. Whatever you do, friends, however badly you treat me, and you've never treated me badly, but if you ever do in the future, hang me for my misdeeds, but don't rehabilitate me like a machine that's gone wrong. I'd prefer to die as a person than be reorganized as a machine. Treat me as the person I am. Give the dignity of the fact that I have made my decision. Bad and lousy decision, okay, but I have made them myself. But don't mechanize me. And my suspicions are that's what you want too. And that just reflects a Christian understanding. Now, where am I up to on the notes? Where are you up to on the notes? All over the back page and back and forth. That's tomorrow's talk. You see, you're in a real mess now, aren't you? Some of you have actually just changed all those little ones into Z, 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 Z across the top, haven't you? Well, now, where I am anyway is up on hell. What a mess, you see. It's all a result of God's character and a result of man's character. Those 2 points I'm dealing with at this stage of the game. See them there under 4, 1 and 2? And because God is a holy, righteous God, you got it there? Because God's a holy, righteous God who is a personal God, who hates sin, who is vengeful, because he's retributive, and because we are people made in his image whom he treats responsibly, so he gives punishment to those. So he takes action against man's action. And our actions, when they're abhorrent to him, get treated with his abhorrence. Now, where do you see this taking place? In three places. One, in history. Two, in death. And three, in eternity. They're points 3, 4, 5. You'll notice there. And now we're going up the home straight. We'll go a lot quicker. Do you need to go quicker? Do you need more exercise? Let's press on. Shall we? You see it in history, in the rise and fall of nations. Look at me with me, will you? Back to Genesis there for a few moments. Genesis 15. Genesis 15. Here God is telling Abraham what is going to happen in the future to Abraham and his children. Well, to his children in particular, seeing it's 400 years down the track. And he says, verse 14, Genesis 15, verse 14, I will punish the nation they serve. I will punish the nation they serve. Speaking of Egypt, that's the nation they're going to serve. I will punish it. I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. You remember where we are at the moment? There's the Mediterranean. Here is the Jordan and the Dead Sea and all that kind of thing. Down here is Egypt. Here is the promised land of Abraham. Sorry about that over the kinds. I mean, years of work putting in maps like that. And you've missed them. Well, here, Abraham's in the promised land. God's saying, this will be your land, but first you're going down here into slavery in Egypt. After 400 years, your people will come out of that slavery, and I will punish the people who treated your descendants as slaves. See, again, God's punishment comes out in history, doesn't it? But more than that, it'll have to wait 400 years, because it's not until 400 years that the sin of the Amorites, who are the people living in the promised land at the moment, will be complete. When their sin is complete, then I will bring your people up and give you the promised land. God doesn't give the promised land to the people of Israel, and God doesn't take away the promised land from the Amorites to give to the people of Israel until the Amorites have done that which is sufficient to deserve the losing of the promised land. See, why does God tell the people of Israel to go in and destroy Jericho? Well, it sounds rough. Poor old Jericho, just sitting there minding their own business, and suddenly all these Jews come down and knock them flat. Now what? It never seems fair, does it? Until you remember that the Jews, the people of Jericho, were the Amorites, who were wicked and sinful people, and whose wickedness and sinfulness was such after 400 years that God could abide it no longer, and the people of Israel were being sent in as a punishment to them. Now do you see why it is that they're there? See, God gives it to them. And you see a promise there to Abraham years and years ago. Now the whole history of Israel is like that, isn't it? The reason the Babylonians beat the people of Israel was because they sinned. The reason the Assyrians beat the people of Israel was because they sinned. And when the people of Assyria sinned, so they were overthrown. As the Babylonians sinned, they were overthrown. And the whole Bible perspective is that God is at work in history, punishing people in the events of history. That is taking place. Mind you, the psalmists keep on saying, hey, God, you're the God who only punishes the wicked and the evil. And look, the wicked and the evil are fat and wealthy and good-looking, and I'm hungry and I'm righteous. There is a typical psalm, free translation, find it anywhere between 1 and 150. But again, the rationale of the psalmist is, you are the God who punishes in history. Now, at the moment I can't see it, so what gives? That's what the argument is. But the argument assumes that God is the God who punishes in history. Not only nationally, but individually. King Saul offers the sacrifice in 1 Samuel 13, that he shouldn't. Not 1 Samuel 13, is it? 1 Samuel, can't read my notes. Yes, 13. 1 Samuel 13, he offers a sacrifice that he shouldn't offer, and so he is punished by being told that his family will be cut off and another king will come in his place. David is punished for his sin with Bathsheba. And you find that the child that is born of Bathsheba dies as a result of David's waywardness and sinfulness in that regard. There are individuals who are punished. There's a dreadful story of punishment. 2 Samuel chapter 6. I like to give you this one because it's such a clear black and white illustration of punishment. It is so unforgettable that will always help you in discussions on this subject in future generations. Whenever you're thinking about it, this one will come back to you. It's a shocker. 2 Samuel 6. Not a well-known story. In fact, most people try and pretend it's not there. The ark has just been won, and they're bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. And verse 6, when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act, and therefore God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. That's a rip snorter of a story, you see. The people of Israel were told never to touch the ark of God. They just won it. They just lost it in battle, and now they just won it back again. And they're bringing it home with great rejoicing. Got it on the back of a cart being pulled by the oxen. The oxen stumble. The ark starts to topple. It's going to fall over. What would you do? Of course you did exactly what Uzzah would do, wouldn't you? You reach out and put your hand up and stop it tumbling. You don't want the ark to fall on the ground and get smashed. You put your hand out to stop it, don't you? He was told never to touch the ark of God. Under no circumstance you ever put your hand on such a thing. He touched it and was killed immediately. It's a great story, isn't it? And that is the reason he was killed. Verse 7, the Lord's anger. Dreadful story. You don't forget that one, do you? You won't ever find it again. Just remember the name Uzzah. And you can always find it in the concordance. There's only one, you know, Uzzah's an unusual name. It's not the only one in the Bible, actually. Uzzah. You see, God punishes in the here and now individuals. He does it through governments. Romans chapter 13 says that the judge wields the sword of God, the wrath of God. Your local magistrate, he may not know that. Right? If your dad's the magistrate and he's not a Christian, don't worry about it, he doesn't know it. But that's what he's doing. He's punishing evildoers on God's behalf. He also visits us with sickness. 1 Corinthians 11, you need to look this one up too, friends, because there are all kinds of people who go around today and saying sickness is never the will of God. Well, let's just show you that that's rubbish. 1 Corinthians 11, 30. The people here are celebrating the Lord's Supper in an ungodly fashion. Some are eating and getting drunk, others are thirsty and getting hungry. They're not loving each other. They've come together for the great love feast of the Lamb, and they're not loving each other. And so it's not the Lord's Supper at all. When you drink, you've got to eat and drink, you've got to examine yourself, he says in verse 28, before he eats the bread and drinks the cup. Anyone who eats and drinks without recognizing the body of the Lord eats and drinks judgment on himself. Verse 30, here it is. That is why many among you are weak and sick, and a number have fallen asleep. Normal euphemism for died. But if we judged ourselves, we would not have come under this judgment. Under judgment, right, is the word. See, the judgment of God fell on the Corinthian Christians in the terms of sickness and death. It's not just that God permitted it to happen. It's not God just stands back. God kills Uzzah. God sends sickness. I am the creator of wealth and woe, says God in Isaiah 45. Good and bad. In that regard, sickness is part of the armoury of God in punishing evildoers. Now, you've got to be careful at this point, because then you say, okay, does that mean every time someone's sick, they've done some sinful thing? Yes and no. Have you ever met anyone who is sick and who has not done something sinful? No. Okay, so you can't just rule it out. But does that mean every time they are sick, it is because they have done something sinful? No, no, the Bible says, no, sickness comes for lots of reasons. Not just because of people's individual sinfulness. And the classic, of course, in that is John chapter 9, with a man who is born blind. And they say, well, who sinned? Was it this man or was it his father that he was born blind? And Jesus said, neither. You see, sometimes, so that helps us a little bit on the subject of the child born with cancer, doesn't it? In that particular illustration we started off on, who sinned? It may have been But you've got to have evidence to prove that it's got something connected with it. And of course, that's what Job is all about, isn't it? Job's comforters. They keep saying, well, you're awful sick. You must have done something awfully bad. Come and tell us about it, will you? I mean, we'll hang a little movie out the front and other people listen in on how bad you're being. And Job keeps saying, I haven't done anything wrong. And they say, oh, come off it. No one could be that sick and not have done something wrong. See, they've made the connection between sin and sickness too tight. There's all kinds of nuts running around Sydney today who are making it completely irrelevant. They say, oh, no, God never wants anyone ever to be sick. Well, that's not true either. You can't divorce them. It's revealed in history. It's also revealed in history in terms of Romans chapter 1. I don't know if you've ever looked at Romans chapter 1, but in the second half of that chapter, it's all about the wrath of God, isn't it? And how is God's wrath revealed in history? God does something that is dreadful to us. Do you know what he does? He lets us do our own thing. You know, sometimes you teach a child by saying, don't do that. Sometimes you teach them by putting a guard in front of them. Sometimes you despair and say, okay, go and learn the hard way. The only way you're ever going to learn is by making a fool of yourself. Well, I'm sorry. Go make a fool of yourself. Now, I don't want to put God verbal, make that exactly the words of God, but that's the kind of thing God's doing. He's actually just letting us have our way. And so we live the life of a lie. We live as if we're God. And it doesn't work. Now, we make a right botch of everything. And that is part of the punishment of God. We distort and destroy every good thing. Work, pleasure, sex, drink, food, everything we monkey up because we're not God and we're playing God. All right? Well, seen in death. The key judgment of God is death. Sickness is the foretaste of it, of course. That's why you can't separate out sickness from the will of God. God is punishing us with death. I don't know whether you know this or not, but everybody who dies, dies of a sickness. And I'll tell you something else, just to make this perfectly clear. Old age is not a sickness. I'm closer to it than most of you. I want to make that very clear. Old age is not a sickness. Right? And no one ever dies of old age. Don't know if you ever grasp hold of that or not. No one ever dies of old age. People die of a sickness in old age. They don't die of old age itself. The heart may give out the... The mind may give out, the blood vessels may get clogged up, and a hundred things may happen in your old age, but the thing happens. Stop this silly nonsense of people going around saying God wants everyone to be whole and perfect all the time. Absolute garbage. Absolute nonsense. That is not the way the world is. It is not the plan and purpose of God. The plan and purpose of God is that everyone is going to die, and everyone is going to die of a sickness. So you can really say that God wants everybody to be sick. Not necessarily at the moment. And I hope not during this week. Living in such close quarters. But he wants everyone to be sick. He is actually going to kill every one of us. Because the wages of sin is death. Where's that verse? I beg your pardon? Ezekiel 3:18. That's got you going, hasn't it? Everyone else has Romans 6:23. Got to have Old Testament experts here as well. Now, the wages of sin is death. The day of you eat of this, you will surely die. Genesis 2:17. Because man has now eaten the fruit of the tree of knowledge of evil and become like one of us, knowing good and evil, therefore he must be set away from the tree of life, lest he eats it and lives forever. Genesis 3:22 and following. And so the whole world is caught up in the death trap. Romans chapter 8 has got a marvellous passage from about verse 18 following. Marvellous passage about the way in which the world now is under the sentence of death. And the whole world is groaning in travail, waiting for the time when it is going to be done away with and a new one that is not under the rule of death will be set up. But until that time, we are all under it. And so we have the march of the maggots. The weeds that always win. So we have the domain of death. Now you see, this is all very helpful, isn't it, in trying to actually understand the way the world is. Got to understand the way the world is. Am I going to live my life expecting always to be healthy? Well, if you are, you're a complete blithering idiot. Why on earth would you expect that? No one lives like that. You expect to live a life that's going to have a lot of health in it and a lot of sickness in it. And in the end, sickness is going to win. You can speed it up, if you like, with a car accident, but still, it's going to win. Don't go through this life thinking everybody's got to be healthy all the time. Now, our society thinks that. That's why they're willing to pay anything for the doctors to keep working. Because they believe in eternal youth. They believe in eternal health. They believe in a myth, in a nonsense. Christians don't have to believe in that nonsense. Christians can face the reality of a world that's gone wrong. We know and understand why. It's because we are part and parcel of the wrath of God, contributing factor to it. Because our very sinfulness increases it. And indeed, we can even see that certain forms of sinfulness will increase even our sickness. Alcoholic excess is one of them, for example. All right, death. But the trouble is the Bible goes further than that and reaches into eternity. Because death is not the end. Death is not the end. Now, if I say death is not the end, who can show me a verse in the Bible that says death is not the end? Hebrews 9:27. It's appointed unto every man to die once, and after that, the judgment. And after that, the judgment. Hebrews 9:27. Yes, another one? I said, can someone tell me a verse? Yes, okay. Anybody else got a verse or two that they... 2 Thessalonians 1:8-9. I wonder what that says. I think you find that in the Bible, but you can also find it in Two Ways to Live. Who would like to recite it for us, please? Okay, who will recite it for us, please? Archie? Alright, so afterwards, when Jesus returns, we will be excluded from the presence of God if we are his enemies. Any others? 2 Thessalonians 1:8 and 9, that was? Which says, please? Yes, thank you, Alan. There's a great picture of judgment there. In other words of John 5:25, you can tell us about John 5:25? Oh, we haven't reached that far in Bible study yet. Yes, we have. Just this first session. What a discouragement. We didn't do chapter 5? I tell you the truth, a time is coming and has now come when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as he has granted life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself, and he has given him authority to judge, because he is the Son of Man. Do not be amazed at this, for a time is coming when all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done good will rise to life, those who have done evil will rise to be condemned. Oh, death is not the end. Oh, see, most of us can cope with annihilation. Not really, you know. If you actually think about annihilation, you can't. You know the old Ilkley Marbard that song, don't you? Ilkley Marbard. You don't know the song? Where have you been since I saw thee? On Ilkley Moorbardat? Well, I'll sing it for you sometime. Ilkley Moor is up in Yorkshire. It's a great spot, if you like bleak spots. And the song says, where have you been since I've seen you? Say, out in Ilkley Moor, you'll catch a death of cold out there. And if you catch a death of cold, then we'll have to bury you. And if we bury you, then the worms will come and eat you up. And if the worms come and eat you up, then the ducks will come and eat the worms. And then when we come and eat the ducks, we will have eaten you. It's a quaint English folk song. You don't really believe in annihilation. You see, you can believe in annihilation provided you don't think about it. Provided you don't consider what you're talking about. You really cope with yourself like... But the Bible won't allow you annihilation anyway. The Bible says there's life after death. And there's destruction that goes on. Now... Please make sure that I understand this right. You see, it's reaching into eternity, but the emphasis is on the destruction, not on the eternity of it. It's eternal because you are cut off from God, so there's no way back. It's eternal because you will continue to sin and not repent, and so there's no way back. It is eternal because you are so absolutely ruined, there's no way you can come back. You are incapable and you have locked yourself off. But it's not, the fundamental thing of it is not eternal. The fundamental thing is that you're ruined. but you are so utterly ruined that there is no resurrection possible anymore. And so, therefore, as a consequence of it, it's a ruin that goes on forever. Ah, the dreadful picture. It's a shocking picture, isn't it? Because, you see, it's a picture of humans. It's a picture of people who can love and laugh and enjoy. Of people that we love. And maybe even of us. You see, what we're dealing with here, friends, is very sad. I try and joke about things because I'm just that kind of personality, but it really is no joking matter at all, is it? The world is coming to an end, and individuals within the world are consistently coming to their end. And face to face with God, there is this dreadful picture of people who are for eternity ruined. So ruined that there is no way back. So cut off from God that there are no longer any promptings in their heart to turn back, nor any preachers to tell them about the way back. So utterly cut off. It's a dreadful picture, isn't it? Separated from everything that's good. And if that is the life that comes from God out of his very character of love and justice, then we should be pleading for something more. That, you know, it can't be right. What we're going to be studying in the week will show what more there is, so don't go home at this sad moment. For there is more, but until we grasp hold of this horror, until we perceive the appalling hopelessness of life without God, we'll have no understanding of what the rest of the week is about. Your mother and father, or your brothers and sisters, your close friends know Christ? If not, can you really see them going into that ultimate destruction from which there is no way back? With equanimity, with ease, with, oh, well, that's the way it is. It must and it should burden our hearts to think that anyone, let alone somebody that I actually love, is ever going to wind up in those terms. It should be that kind of love which makes us angry that it could be like that. You can feel the psalmist, you can cry out and even shake his fist at God and say, well, why? Don't run away from that feeling of anger. It's a right feeling of anger. And it's as we grasp it that mum and dad are going there. That my brother's going there. As it's grasp it that I may be going there, that I can start to grasp what it is that Jesus has done for us and the importance that that will have for the way in which I live and love and relate to mum and dad and my brothers as people I do not even yet know. We've got to take the God who is near, not the God we think or the God we'd like to think of. And when we see the God who is there, he is one of love. Such love that he can never be indifferent to us, the people made in his image, but must treat us responsibly for all that we have done. And if what we have fundamentally done is to reject him and said, look, we want to exist without you, then he treats us with that responsibility by giving us an existence without him. And cut off from God, we're cut off from love and light, from fellowship and goodness, from health and happiness, from anything and everything that is ever worth having. But it is exactly what we asked for. The punishment has fit the crime. We said we wanted to exist without God, and God has given us up to that existence. And all through life we could see it wasn't working. All through life we could see the world was amok, the baby with cancer. All through life we could see the Christians persecuted, we could see the warfare, we could see the hunger. All through life we could see the terrible distortion of self-centeredness that comes into our home. We know that selfishness never works, and yet we go on being selfish. We know that God is there, but we go on suppressing the knowledge. We know that we're making a botch of it. We can see things are wrong, but we're going to go on and ignore the very warnings of God that if you keep going that way, it'll only get worse. God keeps in his love sending judgments upon us to stop us. Early chapters of Amos, he says, I gave them a famine, but they wouldn't come back to me. I gave them floods, they wouldn't come back to me. I gave them lean years, they wouldn't come back to me. I gave them warfare, they wouldn't come back to me. I keep warning them of what is going to happen, but they won't come back to me. Dreadful warnings. The Church of England has said, oh no, it was a freak. We call it an act of God for the insurance policy, but we don't actually think he had anything to do with it. Even though we are now appointing men who do not believe the gospel as the leaders of our church. Why would God think that strange? Why would he take any action? And why would he warn us by doing such a terribly irreligious thing as burning down our idol shrine? If they do not take the warning, is it any wonder that they will continue to be cut off from God and from all his blessings? And if you and I don't take the warnings and our loved ones don't take the warnings, where does it go? And if you don't like it, you're in good company. But God doesn't either. He doesn't want the death of anyone, but rather that he should turn and live. Let's spend a moment in prayer, shall we?
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.